Welcome to our third session of Democratic Faith, the Witness of the Civil Rights Movement with Dr. Derek Woodard Lehman. On this Pentecost Sunday, we, I think, understand that the Holy Spirit was moving throughout the Civil Rights Movement, and we might think about that as we listen to today's session, and Derek will kindly open us with prayer.
Good morning and welcome, or for many of you, welcome back. And we'll pray again the prayer that we used that first week, the one that I prayed with my little boys and still pray with them, even though they're now as tall as I am. Let us pray. God, open minds to learn, open hearts to love, and open hands to share. Amen. This week, we continue our exploration of the longer civil rights movement, the stories behind the headlines, the figures that don't always show up in the newsreels. We've said each week, Julian Bond himself, a student activist and later president of the NAACP, describes that standard story like this. Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and the white kids came down and saved the day. But what we've been doing in our seminars is trying to look beyond this truncated narrative, this desiccated memory of the movement. This version of things looks something like this. We begin with the Brown v. Board decision in 54, Rosa Parks in 55, and Martin King afterwards, the famous March on Washington and the eventual Freedom Rides. Not more than what Boyd or Bond said. Last week, we expanded that history, and we enlarged our memory, reaching back to figures like A. Philip Randolph, who led the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union, W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells, who with others founded the NAACP and began a decades-long anti-lynching campaign, to which we can add Miles Horton, who founded the Highlander Folk School in 1932, which became a think tank and training center for activists like Rosa Parks. To this, we can even add more, the Double V Victory campaign that started right here in Pittsburgh with an op-ed to the Pittsburgh Courier. The Double V was double victory, the defeat of fascism abroad and racism at home, as well as Harry Truman's 1948 efforts to desegregate the military and established the initial Civil Rights Commission. Again, we can't go into all the details. There are many events and figures beyond these, but we can add a few more. In 1947 and 1948, Baird Rustin organized the Journey for Reconciliation, a bus tour that was the forerunner of the Freedom Rides. In 1954, the same year as Brown v. Board, Septima Clark and Esau Jenkins founded the first citizenship schools on the Sea Isles off the coast of Georgia to educate African Americans enough to pass the literacy and poll tests and therefore be able to vote. As we mentioned last time, besides Brown, there were several Supreme Court decisions leading up to Brown that took place over, again, not just days, weeks, and months, but decades. Among them, Morgan v. Virginia, McLaurin v. Oklahoma, and Davis v. Prince Edward County. And these first two phases of the movement leading up to the period we're discussing today culminate in the 1957 Civil Rights Act. Believe it or not, the first civil rights legislation since Reconstruction in the 1800s. And before we move on, let's remind ourselves what we've said before, that it was A. Philip Randolph who first conceived the March on Washington and Baird Rustin, who was the architect of the eventual march in 1963, which we'll talk about in a little while. And of course, at the center of it all, we find Ella Baker. As we said last time, if Martin King is the father of the movement, then Baker is its mother. And as with natural reproduction, it is the mother who does the lion's share of bringing new life into the world. Her work began in the 1930s with the Young Negroes Cooperative League, continued in the 40s with the NAACP, before she was one of the founding members of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In the 30s and 40s, before she joined the SCLC, she crisscrossed back and forth around the South, setting up local branch chapters of the NAACP, raising up and empowering and training and mentoring local leaders. And with Baird Rustin and Stanley Levinson, she was one of the authors of the working papers at that first meeting that became the SCLC. And finally, in the 1960s, she was the mother of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That was the outgrowth of the Nashville sit-in movements that we talked about last week. Recall that Rosa Parks herself was recruited by E.D. Nixon, who was the chair of the Montgomery, Alabama chapter of the NAACP, one of those leaders that Baker had worked with. And Parks herself attended several national leadership conferences organized by Baker, through which the two became friends. And as I said a moment ago, it was Baker, Rustin, and Levinson who set the agenda for that first meeting of the SCLC, particularly around the identity of the organization and its strategy. Baker worked with King for those first few years, trying to expand the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and establishing its local chapters, including the Nashville Christian Leadership Conference, which supported the student sit-in movement that we talked about last time. That movement, under the leadership of James Lawson, Diane Nash, John Lewis, and others, initiated the mass sit-ins that were the first efforts to pioneer and perfect the tactics of nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. That Nashville campaign from February to May eventually won concessions from the city's local businesses, who integrated their lunch counters. This was the movement's first significant victory that was won through civil disobedience. This victory inspired other students across the South to do likewise. So what began with people like Diane Nash and Peggy Alexander eventually expanded across the South, as we see on this map, the stars representing other campaigns across the South run by students. This brings us to our topic for today, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Under the auspices of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and borrowing a fair bit of its money, Baker called for a national meeting of student leaders. It was held in Raleigh, North Carolina at her alma mater, Shaw University, over the Easter weekend of 1960. Over 120 students attended, representing 58 different sit-in campaigns from 12 states, plus 19 northern colleges. Our first week, we noted a strong difference in leadership style and organizational structure within the civil rights movement. Those differences are personified by Ella Baker and Martin Luther King. King's claim, quote, that leadership never ascends from the pews to the pulpit, but descends from the pulpit to the pews, represents the style of leadership in the organizational culture of the NAACP and the SCLC. Whereas Baker's idea of leadership is, quote, strong people don't need strong leaders. I've always thought that what is needed is the development of people who are not so much interested in being leaders themselves as in developing leadership in others. Baker had long chafed against that more elitist leadership culture, the lawyerocracy of the NAACP and the preacherocracy of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which were both elitist and sexist. Because she saw in the emerging sit-in movement leaders who were both generationally and organizationally independent of these other entities, she saw an opportunity to break free from this top-down hierarchy and build a broad-based grassroots bottom-up organization. In these students, she saw the strong people that were strong leaders, who were capable not only of leading themselves, but developing leadership in others. So above all else, Baker's purpose in calling that first meeting at Shaw University was to protect the students, to maintain their independence. King's plan was essentially to make the students youth chapters of his organization, the SCLC. But Baker had a different idea. In the words of her invitation letter, she says, adult freedom fighters will be present to offer counsel and guidance, but the meeting will be youth-centered. By this time, Baker was so well known and so highly regarded that leaders in the student citizen movement trusted her. As one student, Chuck McDew, said, quote, if Miss Ella Baker wants you to do something, you can put your life in her hands. Throughout that weekend's worship, workshops, discussions, and decisions, four important things emerged. First, as the name indicates, SNCC would not be a centralized, bureaucratized organization. It would be a confederation of independent local organizations who coordinated on strategy while maintaining their independent identity. Second, the prominence and influence of the Nashville group, especially John Lewis and Diane Nash, solidified the students' commitments to nonviolence, and especially Christian nonviolence. In their statement of purpose, the students said, we affirm the philosophical and religious ideal of nonviolence as the foundation of our purpose, the presupposition of our faith, and the manner of our action. Nonviolence, as it grows out of the Judeo-Christian traditions, seeks a social order of justice permeated by love. This statement of purpose cemented their resolve to continue direct, active, confrontational civil disobedience. This, in contrast to the mode and method of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which preferred passive, indirect resistance through things like boycotts. Third, through what were called informal buzz sessions, just basic conversations, students engaged in lengthy dialogues. They conversed about their different efforts across the South. They compiled stories and shared notes about the sit-in campaigns. Stories that were compelling because, as Diane Nash puts it, success is persuasive. Some of these stories were published in the student report on the sit-ins, individual first-person accounts which were representative of the students' wider experience. This report was a manifesto for the students themselves at the meeting and for those who would join them, stating their unyielding demands for equality and justice and their unbending resolve to suffer confrontationally to achieve those ends. Fourth and finally, as the SNCC emblem communicates, the students committed themselves to a twofold approach to race. SNCC would be and would remain a Black-led organization, even as it would be an integrated organization. The students would embody and enact among themselves the very equality and harmony they seek to create in the wider society. Again, in the words of their statement of purpose, quote, integration of endeavor represents the first step towards such a society. In theological terms, which many of the students used, especially those who were seminarians, SNCC was a lived theology and a partially realized eschatology. The group would be a sign, instrument, and foretaste of God's kingdom, of what Martin Luther King and others called the beloved community. SNCC immediately put their statement of purpose into practice. A year later, those commitments were put to the test during the 1961 Freedom Rides. After schools and lunch counters, interstate transit and accommodations were the next target for desegregation. The Congress on Racial Equality planned a series of integrated bus rides beginning in April 1961. Just as the Little Rock Nine had put Brown v. Board to the test with respect to desegregation of schools, groups of freedom riders, 12 at a time, six white and six black, would put into practice the 1960 Boynton v. Virginia SCOTUS ruling, desegregating interstate travel. As you know of the Little Rock Nine, the Freedom Riders also face repression and reprisals. After a week of intensive training, a first group of riders left Washington, D.C. on May 4th, bound for Montgomery, Alabama. Among them were John Lewis and Joan Mulholland. The riders, of course, encountered resistance, indeed violence. In Anniston, Alabama, just before reaching Birmingham, they were beaten. We see here John Lewis and James Peck covered in blood. There, their bus was also firebombed. Fortunately, everyone escaped. Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a pastor in Birmingham and a leader in King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, sent a rescue convoy to Anniston to retrieve the group, but they only made it as far as Birmingham. At that point, the Freedom Rides were dead in their tracks. John Lewis flew back to Nashville, where he met with Diane Nash and other leaders in the Nashville movement. Those three, in consultation with their wider group, decided that they would press on. A week later, they and nine others left Nashville for Montgomery via Birmingham. Reverend Shuttlesworth, on instructions from Martin Luther King, strongly urged them not to come for fear of violence or even death. In response, Diane Nash said this: "That's exactly why the movement must not be stopped. If they stop us with violence, the movement is dead. The students have decided. We just want to know if you can meet us." The students made it to Birmingham, where they were arrested and immediately deported back across the Tennessee state line. Diane Nash and John Lewis had, of course, anticipated this and had cars waiting to take them back to Birmingham. This confrontation forced the Kennedy administration's hand to intervene with both legal injunctions and police protection. On May 20th, those Nashville students reached Montgomery and restarted the Freedom Rides, which continued across the South throughout December. During that year between the Shaw meeting and the Freedom Rides, Bob Moses had been sent south by Ella Baker. Moses was a veteran of the Virginia sit-in campaigns, and he was a founding member of SNCC. He was recruited by Baird Rustin in New York City and sent to Atlanta to work with Baker in the national offices of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. In the summer of 1960, Baker sent him to Mississippi to begin meeting with her contacts, those leaders she had raised up and worked with earlier in her career, these longtime leaders that scholars often refer to as movement elders. During that year, Baker and Moses met with those leaders and built relationships. Moses met people like Hollis Wilkins, Amesy Moore and his wife Ruth, and E.W. Steptoe. At Baker's direction and with her introduction to these leaders, Moses did the preparatory field work with local organizations and citizens, that intergenerational networking that Baker calls spade work, using an organic gardening metaphor of turning the soil, tilling, and growing. Together, these leaders discerned and developed the strategy for SNCC's Mississippi campaign. Alongside continued efforts of nonviolent direct action for desegregation, the Mississippi campaign would engage in mass voter registration. This idea was first proposed by Amesy Moore, who organized the campaign along with Moses and E.W. Steptoe, who we see here at left. Steptoe had first attempted to vote, or register to vote, in 1953. Having only a sixth grade education, he of course failed the poll test. Undeterred, he founded his local chapter of the NAACP in Amity County on the Louisiana border. Through that chapter, he came into Baker's circle and became one of her most trusted collaborators. Like the Battle of Little Rock, which attempted to claim the rights granted in Brown v. Board, SNCC's voter registration campaign would operationalize the federal law of the 1960 Civil Rights Act. When it was passed, only 4.6% of Mississippi's African-American population was registered to vote, a mere 23,000 citizens. Though they were almost half the population, they had almost no political power. Using Baker's contacts and network, Moses and SNCC began in the Northwest counties along the Mississippi River and the Southern counties bordering Louisiana. As Moses put it in a memo to the national office, quote, "The only attack worth making is an attack aimed at the overthrow of the existing political structure. Such an attack would require mass voter registration, and that would require many more student volunteers." Although not the same as the civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action of sit-ins or freedom rides, as Reginald Robinson said, quote, "If you went to Mississippi and talked about voter registration, they're going to hit you in the head. That's about as direct as you can get." However, even after 2 years of organizing in 1961 and 1962, SNCC had barely registered 4,000 voters, an increase of just 2%. In a January 1963 report, Bob Moses noted three problems stalling the campaign. First, employers would take economic reprisals against those who tried to register to vote. You'd lose your job if you tried to register to vote. There was, of course, direct intimidation and repression, and there were still poll tests and poll taxes. All of this, both the success of SNCC's organizing and the challenges of its voter registration campaign, are embodied in the story of Fannie Lou Hamer. Show of hands, how many know about Fannie Lou Hamer or have at least heard the name once, twice, maybe a couple? Not everybody. Hamer was a sharecropper on the Marlowe Plantation in Ruleville, Mississippi. In August 1962, she went to a SNCC meeting held at a church, as they most often were. She heard James Bevel, who was part of the Nashville student group, preach, and following that sermon, James Forman spoke on civil rights and voter registration. At the end of the service, when they asked for volunteers to register to vote, she put up her hand. The following morning, a busload of people went to Indianola to register to vote, but only two, including Hamer, were even allowed to sit for the poll test. She spent all day writing answers about questions to the Mississippi Constitution. Her employer, upon hearing this, threatened to fire her and her husband from their work, which in turn would mean they would lose their home on the plantation. So she left her family to let them continue to work and to keep their house. In the interim, she kept going to meetings throughout 1962. As she did, she developed a reputation, both for the ordinary courage of her convictions when she spoke and for the extraordinary range of her singing, which we see here in several of these photos. On the strength of that reputation, Bob Moses asked another SNCC worker, Charles McLaurin, to quote, "Go and get me the lady who sings the hymns." He invited her to the annual conference in Nashville, after which Hamer joined SNCC as a full-time field secretary, taking on leadership, and eventually, after two more failed attempts, succeeding herself in registering to vote. She later attended one of those South Carolina citizenship schools for a training where she met Septima Clark. On the way back home, Hamer and those with her, including a 15-year-old girl named June Robinson, were arrested after attempting to be served at a lunch counter in Winona, Mississippi. They were tortured and beaten all night in that Winona jail. Undeterred, Hamer said, "Killing or no killing, I'm going to stick with civil rights." She became even more vocal as a leader and organizer, singing and speaking across Mississippi, telling her story, giving her testimony, and recounting her ordeal in that jail. She inspired and encouraged countless others, including Annie Devine, who was only 17, who said, "Why not follow somebody like that? Why not just reach out with one hand and say, just take me along?" With Moses Moore, Steptoe, and others, Hamer organized the 1963 Freedom Vote. The Freedom Vote was a year-long campaign to run parallel to the mainstream electoral process. SNCC rostered and attempted to register an alternative slate of candidates, a slate that included Fannie Lou Hamer herself, who ran for Congress. The purpose of that campaign was fourfold. It was first a protest against the exclusion from the Mississippi State Democratic Party. It second was a program to educate voters about electoral procedures. And third, it was a publicity stunt for SNCC's wider voter registration efforts. But most importantly, it was proof that Blacks did want to vote, that they would turn out to vote, and that they could not be deterred from the effort to vote. Although the freedom ballots, of course, did not count because they were not recognized, the 1963 Freedom Vote was an overwhelming success, with some 79,000 ballots cast and establishing proof of concept. This set the stage for the Freedom Summer of 1964, to which we'll return in just a moment. 1963, of course, was the year of the historic March for Jobs and Freedom, which, as we've noted several times, was the brainchild of A. Philip Randolph and was designed and implemented by Baird Rustin. Besides Rustin and Randolph, among those in attendance were John Lewis, who spoke on behalf of SNCC, Rosa Parks, and of course, as always, Ella Baker. At that march, King gave his now iconic "I Have a Dream" speech. That speech had been drafted for King by Stanley Levinson and Clarence Benjamin Jones. And the prepared text did not include the refrain, "I have a dream." King had been using that since November of 1962 and had used it again just a few months earlier in June. If you've ever heard a really, really good recording of the speech, especially if you listen to it on headphones, you can hear gospel singer Mahalia Jackson say, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." King responds to her prompt and extemporaneously, off script, tells us about the dream. That summer day in D.C. on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the charismatic leadership of King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference came together with the Democratic organizing of SNCC and other groups. They turned out over 250,000 marchers. During this crucial moment, it crystallized the power of Democratic organizing and mass mobilizing, and it catalyzed public opinion. As we said from the start, our point is not to ignore King altogether, but rather to refocus on long-neglected leaders beside him, like Randolph, Rustin, Baker, and Lewis. We'll return to King and Washington in a moment, however, for a low point rather than a high point of the movement. Building on the success of that 1963 Freedom Vote, Moses, the Mississippi SNCC staff, and their longstanding local partners, along with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the NAACP, and the Congress on Racial Equality, formed the umbrella group, the Council of Federated Organizations, to plan the 1964 Mississippi Summer Project, better known as Freedom Summer. Freedom Summer was a three-pronged attack on Mississippi. It was a massive voter registration campaign alongside a comprehensive educational program. Citizenship schools for adult registrants to be able to pass tests, freedom schools for children and high school students, both of which teaching the lessons of organizing and nonviolent direct action. These schools were built on the model designed by Septima Clark and Esau Jenkins in South Carolina. And third, the Freedom Project would be an aggressive challenge to the Dixiecrats of the standing Democratic Party. The project began with training and orientation at the Western College for Women, which is now part of Miami University of Ohio. That orientation and training was run by leaders from the Highlander Folk School, where Parks had attended her workshops in 1955, as well as SNCC field staff from Mississippi, including Bob Moses. The training was a wide-ranging program that was both theoretical and practical. Students were introduced to the tenets of Christian nonviolence, as well as the tactics of direct action and civil disobedience. They were immersed in the practices of democratic organizing, long hours of patient discussing and debating, deliberating and deciding. And as Charlotte told us last week of the Nashville workshops, they were inducted into the experience of violence, role-playing abuse and physical attack scenarios in order to practice their courage and develop their self-control. When the more than 1,000 students who volunteered and came to training asked what they should expect in Mississippi, Bob Moses, Fannie Lou Hamer, James Lawson, among others, answered honestly. They said that these mostly white Northern students should expect jailings, beatings, even killings. When the assistant U.S. attorney for civil rights visited the training and was asked what protection the federal government would offer the volunteers, he said none. Because of the large numbers, volunteers were recruited and dispatched in waves. They rode the now desegregated buses from Ohio to Mississippi as a new round of Freedom Riders. But in between the first and second wave of Freedom Riders, word was received that three civil rights workers had gone missing. James Chaney, Mickey Schwerner were longtime Corps staffers. Andrew Goodman was a student from the Volunteer Project who had been in Mississippi only a few hours when he was abducted. Moses explained that the trio most certainly were dead, that in all likelihood they'd been beaten, even tortured. He also said to them, "I don't want to put you at risk, but I have to put you at risk. All I can say is I'll be there with you." Undeterred, almost all the volunteers completed their training and boarded buses to Mississippi, where, like Moses, Hamer, Steptoe, and countless others before them had done for the preceding 3 years, the students went door to door, house to house, person by person, registering voters. As expected, the 10-week summer project faced fierce and often violent resistance. Almost 1,100 people were arrested. 80 student volunteers were beaten. 37 churches were bombed or burned, and 30 Black homes and businesses also bombed or burned when they registered to vote. Although the project failed to register a large number of voters, it was nonetheless a success, because within the project emerged the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Again, show of hands, how many have heard of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party? Couple. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the MFDP, oftentimes just referred to as the Freedom Democrats, was both a political reaction to racist exclusion by the Dixiecrats, as well as a practical extension of that 1963 freedom vote. It was a parallel Black-led political party. Crucially, the Freedom Democrats conducted their parallel nomination and election process in full compliance with the national bylaws of the Democratic Party. In other words, just like desegregation forced the issue of the supremacy clause of the Constitution that says that federal law trumps local law when it comes to lunch counters and buses, the Freedom Democrats did the same with the bylaws of the Democratic Party. Beginning in the summer of 1964, they registered 80,000 members for their party through door-to-door canvassing. They conducted regular local precinct meetings, as well as countywide meetings and electoral district meetings, all of which led to a statewide convention attended by 800 delegates. Those delegates had been duly nominated and appointed at 40 county conventions, who voted on a slate of delegates adopted at the 5 district conventions, including Hamer, who again ran for Congress. These delegates in turn nominated and appointed 68 delegates to attend the National Convention of the Democratic Party in Atlantic City, 64 Black delegates, 4 white delegates. Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker, as we see in the photo on the right, both attended the state convention. Hamer was vice chair of the party and a nominee for Congress. Baker gave the keynote address. Those 68 delegates with dozens of observers and supporters headed to Atlantic City. We see here Hamer and Moses arriving in Boardwalk Hall on Friday, August 21st. Upon arrival, the Freedom Democrats petitioned to be seated instead of the regular Mississippi delegation on grounds that the racist exclusion of the Dixiecrats invalidated their delegation. Here's how that petition and challenge unfolded. Aaron Henry, the state chairman of the NAACP, presented the case to the Credentials Committee the next day on Saturday, August 22nd. That committee of 110 members was chaired by none other than David Lawrence, governor of Pennsylvania, for whom our convention center is named. You can see the file cabinets in the background with the documentation of the Freedom Democrats. Copies of voter registrations, ballots cast for the MFDP, and affidavits about being turned away from primary polls, not being allowed into precinct meetings, and so forth. All the evidence that would be necessary to vindicate their claim. Ever the organizer, Baker had done her spade work before the convention. She had secured a public pledge to support the Freedom Democrats from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin Luther King, who we see here testifying before the Credentials Committee on August 22nd, saying publicly what he had said privately to Lyndon Johnson, namely that, quote, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party must be seated because it is the only democratically constituted delegation from Mississippi. Baker also wrangled support from 25 sitting representatives of Congress, and upon arrival in Atlantic City, she whipped 40 votes from the Credentials Committee, needing only 11 to get the matter referred to the floor for a full vote. She also had 9 state delegations prepared to make a motion for that vote, needing only 8. So the cry of the Mississippi Freedom Democrats was 11 and 8, the necessary votes to get their case heard before the full convention. Everything was in place for Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony later that afternoon. If King mounted the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to cash a legal promissory note in his dream speech, Hamer and the Freedom Democrats stepped to redeem a debt paid for with flesh and blood. She related her own experiences of domination and humiliation as a sharecropper. She reported her harrowing ordeal in the Winona jail. And she recalled the sacrifice of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, whose bodies had finally been found during the state convention, and in whose memory the Freedom Democrats had voted, and whose burned out car they towed to the convention and parked on the boardwalk outside the conference. During her speech, which was nationally televised, Hamer famously said, "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." And she warned, if the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is not seated, I question America. While all this unfolded, Mississippi Freedom Democrats and SNCC workers kept vigil on the boardwalk round the clock, silent but defiant. In the meantime, back in Washington, Lyndon Johnson, pictured with King here in 1963, was busy pulling strings behind the scenes. Johnson, of course, needed renomination at the Atlantic City Convention. Most importantly, he needed his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, to be certified. Fearing that Southern delegations might walk out if the Freedom Democrats were seated, Johnson urged Lawrence to delay the vote as long as he could. Lawrence did so by appointing a subcommittee chaired by Walter Mondale, to whom Johnson had promised Hubert Humphrey's vacant Senate seat if he could prevent the party from being seated. In the meantime, LBJ's staffers intimidated and incentivized members of the committee who were prepared to vote to seat the Freedom Democrats, saying they would be rewarded or punished depending on what they did. King himself was threatened by Walter Reuther, who flew in by private plane. Reuther was the chair of the United Auto Workers Union. He was a member of the planning committee for the DC March. And he told King in no uncertain terms, your funding is on the line. The kind of money you got in Birmingham is available for Mississippi, but only if you help us and we help Johnson. Johnson himself, seeing Hamer's speech as it was broadcast on national television, recognized the danger, and he staged an impromptu press conference so the networks would cut away from her to him, which they did. As Hubert Humphrey remarked, quote, the president will not allow that illiterate woman to speak from the floor of the convention. The network circumvented Johnson's maneuver by broadcasting her speech in its entirety during that evening's news. With this, Johnson, Humphrey, and the Democratic Party, in the words of Joseph Rao, the lawyer for the Freedom Democrats, quote, chose to vote for the Mississippi power structure that had murdered Cheney, Schorner, and Goodman, rather than for the people those three boys gave their lives for. The few remaining supporters of the Freedom Democrats struggled to salvage a compromise. Two proposals were floated. Edith Green, a representative from Oregon, suggested an even division between the two Mississippi delegations, meaning half of the Freedom Democrats would be seated. President Johnson rejected that compromise. When he did, Baird Rustin negotiated for two at-large seats, meaning you could go, but you couldn't vote. One for Aaron Henry, the chair of the NAACP and the MFDP gubernatorial candidate, and one for Ed King, the white chaplain at Tougaloo College, as well as a promise to recognize the Freedom Democrats in the next election cycle. Baker, Moses, Hamer, the MFDP delegates, and the SNCC observers deliberated and debated all night at Union Baptist Church. Although King had publicly withdrawn his support, he was sober in his advice at that meeting, saying, quote, being a Negro leader, I want you to take this. But if I were a Mississippi Negro, I would vote against it. Whether he meant to or not, King's remarks betray that distance and difference between the top-down leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the bottom-up organizing of SNCC and the Mississippi Freedom Democrats. When a vote was finally taken in the wee hours of the next morning, the 68 delegates voted unanimously to reject the compromise. That morning, August 25th, with Ella Baker and Stokely Carmichael at her side, as we see at bottom right, Hamer told the crowd outside the convention, we didn't come all this way for no two seats. In a rather perverse irony, the seats of the Mississippi delegation remained empty. The Dixiecrats refused to support Johnson and walked out of the convention anyhow. John Lewis, at the time a SNCC observer who accompanied the Freedom Democrats, seen here with Aaron Henry and Roy Wilkins, recalls this. That was the turning point of the civil rights movement. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Until then, despite every setback and disappointment and obstacle we had faced over the years, the belief still prevailed that the system would work, that the system would listen, that the system would respond. Now, for the first time, we made our way to the very center of the system. We had arrived at the doorstep and found the door slammed in our face. In the end, the culmination of SNCC's organizing and the Mississippi Freedom Project was brought low by the Democratic National Committee's confrontation in Atlantic City. The movement, of course, continued as we see here in this 1965 photograph. LBJ signing the Voting Rights Act on August 5th, shaking hands with Martin Luther King, while Ralph Abernathy, Rosa Parks, and others look on. This resulted in part from the Selma to Montgomery March. Like King's dream speech, the march is only the most famous part of the Selma campaign. Begun in 1963, 2 years earlier, by SNCC organizers Collier Lafayette and Bernard Lewis, as part of SNCC's wider Alabama voting project, run by Prathia Hall and Diane Nash, among others. A campaign that at the time King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference declined to support. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference turned up 2 years later in 1965. King spoke at a January rally, staged his arrest in February, and returned in March after the first attempt to walk from Selma to Montgomery ended on the Edmund Pettus Bridge during Bloody Sunday. Selma notwithstanding, after Atlantic City, the radical democratic intent and Christian nonviolent commitment of the movement began to dissipate. We'll talk about that and tie things together next week, drawing out some of the various dimensions of the movement's democratic faith and its lessons for discipleship and citizenship today. For now, we have some time for questions and conversation. Just wait for Ted with the microphone so the Zoom can hear.
I'm blown away with how little I knew. That was a whole bale of hay you just gave me. really need to watch it again.
Yeah, it's a bigger and longer story. We know what we got in our social studies textbooks. We know what we see in the famous photographs and the newsreels. So there's all this other stuff that happens before, behind, and beyond sort of those big headline events.
What response do you get from students when you take them through all this?
It depends. I mean, the main reaction is, oh golly, I didn't know any of this, or I didn't know a lot of this. Because, you know, we tell grand heroic tales about Martin Luther King, maybe Rosa Parks, but we don't look at all the other stuff. So, you know, the most common reaction is, wow, there's a lot more to this. Second, a reaction, something of the form, God, that's a lot of work.
You know, well, it is.
In terms of like, okay, thousands of student and citizen volunteers over days, weeks, months, years. You know, it's kind of like if you cook, you know, like you can spend 3 hours making something wonderful and delicious that takes all this time, and then it's gobbled up in 35 minutes, right? So there's a sort of similar relationship between all the slow, patient, behind the scenes networking, organizing, building that gets you that one momentous afternoon on the mall in Washington, D.C., or that one march from Selma to Montgomery over a couple of days.
So how did Lyndon Johnson get from opposing at the at the convention to signing the voting rights bill.
Good. So this is another question that comes up sometimes. So Johnson, despite his more than middling bigotry, you know, we have tapes and statements of him using the N-word and, you know, such behind closed doors, was, despite that, a fairly, scare quotes, progressive president who passed legislation first when he was in Congress, then signed as president. So Johnson, like many politicians, is an ambiguous figure. He has good commitments to do some of the right things, but he's also incredibly self-interested. So what happens in Atlantic City is his self-interest trumps his principles. He's like, I can't let this thing fall apart. If these people from Mississippi get on the floor, this is going to fall apart and I won't be president anymore. So, you know, the fancy way of talking about this when it comes up, you know, in a classroom is to talk about the relationship between justice, doing what's right, and prudence, doing what works. Now, if we're lucky, justice and prudence link up and we do the right thing and get the right result. But as you know from your own life, a lot of times you're making compromises and trade-offs. So, you know, Johnson's making trade-offs for his own self-interest. Maybe in the back of his mind somewhere he's thinking, if I stay president, I can do good things. Therefore, I'm going to make, you know, like if you're playing chess, you sacrifice a powerful piece here at move 6 to get in a better position at move 15. King, similarly, will take your money away. That means no more marches, no more rallies, no more of any of that stuff. So King makes his own decision about prudence and justice, withdraws his public support for the right thing, ceding the Freedom Democrats, in the interest of maintaining the ability to do other things at other times. And we can make our own judgments about whether
I take a more liberal view of Johnson. I see him as being more pragmatic, and you can't push a rope. It's true today in terms of politics. Timing is everything. You know, sure, it'd be nice to hit things with a hammer and really make it right, but I don't know what I'd do if I was Johnson. Yeah.
This may not be exactly on target with where you were going with your more recent questions, but I was going to comment that one of the things that happened during the nonviolent work with SNCC in Nashville was that Jim Lawson, of course, was doing the workshops. And he was fantastic. He'd been in Nashville. He was in Raleigh, went to Memphis, but he was a student at Vanderbilt in the Divinity School. He was dismissed because of his work. And for those of us in SNCC that were working there, that was devastating. And partly because it seemed like a symbol of what was happening with bureaucracies. But this was not your typical bureaucracy. This was a divinity school in an institution that was supporting supposedly freedom of speech, academic rights, human rights. And it was really difficult for many of us working with SNCC to see that happen, but it also helped to energize the cause because we were really angry. It felt so wrong. And later he was reinstated, and Harvey Branscombe, who was the chancellor at the time, in his later years, I think he was either late 80s, early 90s, actually met with Jim Lawson and apologized. And Fred Craddock, for example, who was there, was talking with me about it, said it was one of the most moving ceremonies that he had ever seen. So there was a resolution, but during the time it was really a slam. It was another door slam.
was that generationally, young people were not beholden to the same kinds of interest and self-interest as adults. So, you know, if you're a pastor with a family and a salary and a congregation, that's a different calculus than if 18, then it's just you. So she saw in and that allowed for more courageous experimentation with resistance. Student things for adults made. But of course, as the campaign builds, and as we saw in the plenty of adults who were same kinds of risks. That you were,
I think it's somewhere in your micro. See, it goes with your movement.
Is there a museum or a place where all this is clearly presented, or is it always biased, each group having their own idea of what went on? When I was in the 50s, I was starting a freshman in college, and I heard about, I wanted to join the NNATT, and I did, and I had hardly any money, but I sent what I could, and they sent me a membership card, and I put it on my bulletin board, and my roommate took it down. When I came back, he said, "What'd you do that for?" She said, "Well, you won't, nobody will date you or anything." And I put it back up, and she kept putting it back down. And it was like, but then she was secretly engaged and left campus, and I could leave it up. But I wish, is there a complete story told anywhere?
Yes and no. So I don't know if there's going on with this guy. There are links to
Have you ever thought about going to WQED and proposing a 4-week documentary? No, but yeah. Okay.
There's some really good
I'm interested in, I believe CBS took a lot of grief over their filming of the Emmett Bridge. And I didn't know if one organization of the three was, or if there was any collusion there to suppress information. The film is powerful, and you can't think of this whole process would have been sped up if there was more film. People react to film and pictures and
so I'm struck by the ambiguity of Lyndon Johnson's legacy that you talked about, and that it's important because of the context in which we're viewing this, where we recognize the depravity of people and the need for grace, and even people trying to do good things, which step back from Lyndon Johnson. He did lots of terrible things. He also did some good things. And you say, you know, people, they do awful things, but we've got God's grace on our side. Right. And what was Lyndon Johnson's slogan about Barry Goldwater? Goldwater said, "In your heart, you know he's right." And Johnson said, "In your guts, you know he's nuts."
And here's the calculus he made, and here's the kind of hardball. Thank you very much.
Thank you.